Matthew chapter 9 verse 35 to chapter 10 verse 8. The 43rd talk in a series on the Gospel of Matthew was presented by Ron Julian on July 15, 2018 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2018. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're continuing with our series in Matthew. We're beginning a new section. Essentially, we're going to be looking at chapter 10, although we're going to start with 9:35. Today's going to be mostly introductory. We're going to start getting into the meat of chapter 10 next week. So let's read this last little bit of chapter 9, starting with verse 35. Jesus was going through all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. Seeing the people, he felt compassion for them, because they were distressed and dispirited, like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Therefore, beseech the Lord of the harvest to send out workers into his harvest." And then right after these verses, we come into chapter 10. In chapter 10, Jesus sends his 12 disciples out to minister on his behalf. So these short verses that we just read serve as a kind of a transition. First, they review what Jesus has been doing in the previous chapters, preaching the gospel of the kingdom and healing people, as we've been seeing in the chapters we've been looking at. Then they comment that while he traveled around, he saw how lost and needy the people were, and he felt compassion. So he comments to his disciples that they should pray that God would send more workers into the harvest, that is, more people to proclaim the gospel to the people. And so, as we shall see, Jesus follows this up by sending his 12 disciples out to do just that. It's kind of sneaky. First he says, pray for it, and he says, now you're going to go do it. Now let's look a little more closely at these verses, though. I want to talk about them a bit. 9:35 says, Jesus was going through all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. So, if you are looking in your Bibles at 9:35, stay there. Don't move with me, but I'm going to shift back to Matthew 4:23. And you read 9:35 while I read 4:23. Jesus was going throughout all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness among the people. So, as you can see, Matthew 4:23 is virtually identical to 9:35, with just a few little changes. The earlier verse, 4:23, served to introduce the ministry of Jesus. He was traveling through cities and villages, teaching, proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, and healing. But we haven't really seen much of that when we're told about it in 4:23. In chapters 5 through 9, then, we see some of that play out. We see the Sermon on the Mount, and we see a number of miraculous healings, which we've been talking about. So, and that section then concludes with a virtual repeat of the summary of Jesus' activities, and that's in 9:35. So, the section kind of begins with a statement that's very similar to what it says at the end of it. So in part, these two repetitious verses serve to kind of bracket chapters 5 through 9, this very important section of teaching and miracles. But this time, the second time he says it, that summary also serves to prepare us for a new section. Now we're moving on to something new. In 9:36, then, we see that his traveling ministry has aroused a strong response in Jesus. So by repeating that he's been doing these things, he's been going around and teaching, and he's been healing, now we're going to hear what it is he has observed while he's been doing this. Seeing the people, he felt compassion for them because they were distressed and dispirited like sheep without a shepherd. So as Jesus traveled around, he saw that the people were distressed and dispirited. They were troubled and cast down. They were like sheep without a shepherd. And in a few verses, Jesus is going to refer to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Now, this imagery, I think, is easy to understand. You have to understand that I myself personally know nothing about agriculture, farming, plants, animals, anything biological in the whole world, basically. Unless I can see it on the internet, then I might have know something a little bit about it. But even I get the impression that there are some things about sheep and shepherds that kind of make sense. Sheep need a shepherd. The shepherd leads the sheep to pasture. The shepherd protects them from predators. The shepherd keeps them from wandering off from the fold, from the place of safety. Without a shepherd, sheep can easily end up going hungry, wandering off, and being attacked by predators. And metaphorically speaking, then, that is what happens to people spiritually without a shepherd, someone to point them in the right direction and protect them from the things that will destroy them. This language of a sheep without a shepherd, however, also has a rich background in the Old Testament. This is language that they would have been very familiar with, usually with reference to Israel. And I'll just give a couple of examples. In Isaiah 53:6, a very famous passage, "All of us, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, but the Lord has caused the iniquity of us all to fall on him." So here, Israel is being pictured like sheep who have gone astray, and the gone astray that he's talking about is into sin and corruption and rebellion. But the suffering servant gives his life as an offering for their sin. In chapter 50, verse 6, "My people have become lost sheep. Their shepherds have led them astray." So here the sheep are lost because the shepherds are bad. Ezekiel 34 is a long discussion of this same kind of theme. It also condemns the bad shepherds of Israel. The sheep are scattered because the shepherds have not looked out for them. But then in verse 23, God says, "Then I will set over them one shepherd, my servant David, and he will feed them. He will feed them himself and be their shepherd, and I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David will be prince among them. I, the Lord, have spoken." So the shepherds that they have been bad and gotten them into a lot of trouble, but one day God is going to give them the one true shepherd. Calls him David, but we're talking about the descendant of David, the Messiah, who is going to be the one true shepherd of Israel. So these passages help to remind us of the true nature of the troubles and sorrows the people are experiencing. It's not just that they're kind of out of a job and things are a little tight. The people are like lost sheep, just as Israel has often been like lost sheep. They are like lost sheep in the sense that they are spiritually and morally lost. They have lost sight of the hope of Israel, the promises of God. So Jesus looks on them and feels compassion because they are lost in a way that only he, the true shepherd, can remedy. He has come to proclaim the good news that is the only true solution to their troubles and sorrows. So I think we should, it's an easy metaphor to understand, but I do think that it is informed and enriched by this picture, how often in the Old Testament it is applied to Israel and their need for a true shepherd from God. Okay, and so out of this compassion, Jesus says to his disciples in 9:37, "Then he said to his disciples, 'The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Therefore, beseech the Lord of the harvest to send out workers into his harvest. I want to come back later to this section, this image of the harvest, say a few more things about it, but here let's just restate the obvious. Working for the harvest here is a metaphor for the sort of thing that Jesus has been doing, proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, calling people to believe that message and act on it and to enter into the kingdom that he has come to bring. And he's encouraging his disciples to pray that God will send more workers to do the same sort of thing, which turns out to be a very meaningful thing to have them pray, since he is going to send the 12 out to be those workers in the next chapter, which let's look at. Chapter 10. Jesus summoned his 12 disciples and gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. Now the names of the 12 apostles are these. The first, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew his brother, and James the son of Zebedee, and John his brother, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew the tax collector, James the son of Alphaeus and Thaddeus, Simon the zealot, and Judas Iscariot, the one who betrayed him. So it specifically says that Jesus summoned his 12 disciples. So it may be that his earlier comments were to his larger group of disciples. He made the comment about praying for the Lord of the harvest to send workers to his disciples, and then he summons the 12. So it's possible that it was a larger group. There was a larger group that was following him. In fact, in Luke, we see Jesus sending out disciples twice. The first time he sent out the 12, and that's the same event that we're reading about here in Matthew. But in Luke, the second time he sent out 70 disciples. So there are at least 70 people that we could call disciples of Jesus, students of Jesus, who are following him around. So what we know here is that he may have been talking to all of them, but then he calls the 12 aside and says, I'm going to send you out. The first verse says something we want to pay close attention to. Jesus summoned his 12 disciples and gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. Here's where the structure of Matthew's story that partly I was talking about earlier becomes significant. There really is kind of a flow to this. In 4:29, before chapters 5 through 9, as we saw, Matthew says, Jesus was going throughout all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness among the people. Then we have the Sermon on the Mount, which ends with the people saying that Jesus teaches with authority. Then we have the stories of miraculous healing, several of which emphasize the idea that Jesus is acting with authority, authority from God over disease, over demons, over death. Then we have, as we saw before, 9:35, which repeats the statement from chapter 4. Jesus was going through all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. Now we have 10:1, where Matthew tells us that he's called the 12 together and he says, first of all, that Jesus gave the disciples authority to cast out demons and heal disease. Well, that is what had been said about him. He had authority from God to do those things, and now he is giving authority to the disciples to do the very same thing that he's been doing. And then he repeats the language that we saw in 4:23 and 9:35. In 4:23, it said that Jesus was healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. And then at the end of chapter 9, Jesus was healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. And now Matthew says that Jesus gave the 12 authority to, quote, heal every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. So I really think that Matthew is using the exact same language to describe what the disciples are going to do as he used to describe what Jesus did. So I think he's trying to make a very clear indication to us, this transfer. Jesus is saying, pray that there are workers. In essence, those workers need to go out and do the very thing that I am doing, which is to proclaim the gospel and to show these miraculous signs from God. And so just what Jesus had been doing now is what the disciples are being sent out to do. So just as Jesus had authority to heal, so presumably he has authority to grant that authority to others. In other words, God has said to the man Jesus, your actions shall be my actions. If you say a person will be healed, that person will be healed. And if you say an apostle can have that authority as well as you, then I will give the apostle that authority. That's what I would understand to be happening here, that Jesus is saying, I'm commissioning you to do the thing that I have been doing. So Matthew, it seems to me, has made it very clear. Jesus is sending out the 12 to be an extension of his own work. He has authority to heal every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. They will have authority to heal every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. Matthew then gives us a list of the 12 apostles. Let me read that again. Now the names of the 12 apostles are these. The first, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew his brother. And James, the son of Zebedee, and John his brother. Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew the tax collector, James the son of Alphaeus and Thaddeus, Simon the zealot, and Judas Iscariot, the one who betrayed him. Matthew uses the word apostle here for the first and only time in the book of Matthew. The word means something like one who is sent out as a representative. So this is a very appropriate place to use that word, because this is the very place where the 12 are being sent out as representatives of Jesus. They are apostles, they are messengers, they are representatives from the one who sent them. Obviously, the 12 apostles were a very important group. My understanding would be that many of them were still alive at the time Matthew wrote, so this list would be important to Matthew's readers. Matthew, Mark, and Luke each have a list of the 12 like this. There is also a list of the 12 minus Judas at the beginning of Acts. So we have four places in the New Testament where we have a list of who the apostles are. And I want to just make a few brief observations about this list. I'll keep it short, but just a couple things that are sort of interesting about it. When we compare all four lists, we see certain patterns. Why are these patterns here? That's another question, but there are some patterns. Not four groups. Each list can be divided into groups of four. Each group of four has the same four apostles. Each group of four starts with the same person, but within those groups of four, the remaining members vary in order. So let me explain this. So the first group of four in all of the lists are Peter, Andrew, James, and John. In all of the gospel lists, Peter is always first. But Andrew, James, and John vary in order. Matthew has grouped them as brothers. Simon Peter and Andrew are brothers. James and John, the sons of Zebedee, are brothers. So that's how Matthew has organized the first thing. And he's saying so. He's making it clear. These are the guys who are brothers. These are the guys who are brothers. That's how he organizes it. In the other lists, though, it's not necessarily organized that way. The order can be different. Partly because, although Andrew has importance in the fact that he is related to Peter, right? And then James and John. Of those four, the three of them, Peter and James and John, are often together doing things with Jesus separately. So it's like in the other list, sometimes those three are put first because they seem to always end up being where the action is. So it kind of depends how you think about how you want to organize your list. The next group is Philip, Bartholomew, Thomas, and Matthew. In this group, Philip is first in all the lists, but the rest vary in order. The final group is James, the son of Alphaeus, Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot. In this group, James, son of Alphaeus, is always first, and Judas Iscariot is always last, because we want to put Judas last in the list. However we organize things, we want to put Peter first in the whole list, and Judas is going to be last in the whole list. For some reason, Matthew has paired the apostles. I tried to bring that out when I was reading it. It's this guy and this guy, this guy and this guy, this guy and this guy, like so. Why did he do that? Well, Mark says that Jesus sent them out in pairs, so it's possible that Matthew's pairings represent the actual pairs of guys who went out to do this ministry. It's hard to say. Some of the apostles in this list we know nothing about from the New Testament. Bartholomew, James, son of Alphaeus, and Simon the Zealot are never mentioned outside these lists as far as I can tell. Although, some argue that Bartholomew is the same as Nathanael, who we read about in the Gospel of John. Nathanael becomes a disciple of Jesus in the Gospel of John. Is he one of the 12? He's an early disciple. We don't know. Nathanael is not listed in the list of 12, but some argue that he had another name as well, which was Bartholomew, and that's who he was. And again, I don't know. The 12 are an important group in the ministry of Jesus. It's likely that the number 12 was deliberate as an echo of the 12 tribes of Israel. Jesus says in Matthew 19:28, Jesus said to them, "Truly I say to you, that you who have followed me in the regeneration, when the Son of Man will sit on his glorious throne, you also shall sit upon 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel." So there's a very conscious equation of the 12 tribes and the 12 apostles. So it may very well be that the choosing of 12 is a quite deliberate, purposeful act. And clearly Jesus has given these 12 apostles a very important role. On certain important occasions, he confides in the 12 apart from anyone else who's following him. An important one is in Matthew 20:17. As Jesus was about to go up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside by themselves. And on the way he said to them, "Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles to mock and scourge and crucify him, and on the third day he will be raised up." So he explains to them at this point, the 12, he explains to them exactly what astounding events were about to happen. And as you're probably aware, they just did not understand what he was talking about. He tells them in Matthew, you have three times that he tells them, and they do not get what it is that he's talking about. And of course, the greatest example of the importance of the 12 is the way that they were with Jesus at the end. They are the ones who were with him in the upper room on the night when he was arrested. So on this occasion, in our passage, Jesus gathered together the 12, and he's sending them out to minister on his behalf, to represent him, to preach what he's been preaching, and to act, to perform the miracles of healing that he has been performing. So, Matthew 10:5, then, begins the second of five discourses in Matthew. There are these five places where we have a body of teaching that Jesus gives to a particular group. First one was the Sermon on the Mount. And in this case, it is a body of instruction that Jesus gives the disciples when he sends them out. So that's what we're going to find in chapter 10, is here is what he says to them as he sends them out to do this ministry. But before we start into the discourse, which we're only going to do a little bit here today, I have a few comments about what it is we're going to find. Let me make a comment first about the Sermon on the Mount, which was the first of these discourses. Neither Mark nor Luke have exactly the body of teaching we call the Sermon on the Mount that we find in Matthew. Luke has some of the same teaching from the Sermon on the Mount gathered together in a similar way. He seems to be referring to probably the same occasion, although there's some debate, but the same occasion when Jesus was teaching. So Luke has a collection of teachings, and some of those teachings are the same teachings that you find in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew. But many of the pieces that make up the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew are spread throughout the Gospels of Mark and Luke. You find them in various places. So it seems possible that Matthew has gathered together and organized the parts of the Sermon on the Mount. Clearly, Jesus did, on at least one occasion, gather a group of people together and taught them various things. But did Jesus on this one occasion say exactly and only the words that we find in Matthew? Or is the sermon in some way a representative body of teaching that Matthew has organized to show us the kinds of things Jesus taught on many occasions? So people debate, they go back and forth as to how to think about that. Obviously, Jesus probably didn't make his teaching, he didn't say a saying once in one place and then never say it again. I imagine many of the things that he said often as he traveled around and was teaching people. So it could be that this was the stuff that he taught on that occasion, and he also taught those things at other times in other places. Or it may be, in fact, that Matthew has deliberately pulled together for us when he says, here's what Jesus taught. In essence, what he's saying is this is the kind of thing that he was saying to people, and he has pulled it together. It's a little hard to say. The reason I mention that is because when we come to the second discourse, the one we're about to look at, we face the same issue. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all tell the same story of Jesus gathering the 12 disciples and sending them out. And some of the language in Matthew 10 is found in these same stories in Mark and Luke. So if you were to look at parallel accounts, you would see certain parts are the same in all three of them. But some of the language in Matthew 10 comes from other parts of Mark and Luke. Or rather than say comes from, that's presuming something, let's just say are found in other parts of Mark and Luke. One important example is found in Luke. As I told you before, Luke tells of two sending outs. First, he sends the 12, and then he sends 70 disciples out. Some of Matthew's language, rightly enough, is found in Luke's story of the sending of the 12. So they both tell of the sending of the 12, and certain language is the same in both of them. But some of the language in Matthew is found in Luke's story of the sending of the 70. So there's this second occasion, and Luke records Jesus saying certain things. Those certain things, some of them, Matthew has put in this section where he's sending out the 12. So what Matthew includes in one talk to the 12, Luke has split between Jesus talking to the 12 and Jesus talking to the 70. So, I mean, it's hard to say. Likely the 12 were included in that group of 70. So it is likely that these are things that Jesus said to the 12 as well. But Matthew makes no distinction. He has language that we find from the sending of the 12 and the sending of the 70 in Luke together in this one statement, if you understand what I'm saying. Another important example relates to the famous Olivet Discourse. On the Mount of Olives, near the end of Jesus' ministry, close to the time of his crucifixion and resurrection, Jesus talks to his disciples about what is coming in the future. So it's on the Mount of Olives, we refer to it as the Olivet Discourse. This, by the way, is the fifth of the discourses that we find in Matthew. So that's the last discourse that we find in Matthew. But Matthew, Mark, and Luke all have a version of the Olivet Discourse. Each of them have roughly the same sort of thing. Very roughly. But in Matthew, some of the sayings that Mark and Luke put in the Olivet Discourse much later, Matthew has put into this discourse in chapter 10. Specifically, Jesus talks in the Olivet Discourse about how after he is gone, the disciples will be arrested and have to speak before governors and rulers and so forth. Matthew has those words in this section, in the instructions when he sends out the 12. And you can see, when we get to it, we'll look more, but it kind of makes a difference if you think about it as to whether Jesus, those words are referring to things that the disciples are going to encounter in their ministry after Jesus is gone, as they're traveling around, or whether he's talking about the events that they're about to see right now as they go out from village to village. So, how does that all sort itself out? We'll talk about it when we get there. But it really does look as if Matthew has gathered together various things that Jesus told the disciples about what they would face when they went out to minister. On this first occasion when he's sending them out, he seems to have pulled things together from several instructions that Jesus gave them about what they're going to find when they go out there. At least that's a very plausible way of reading what's happening. And he's put them together in this one section when Jesus first sends the disciples out. So, I'm not trying to argue one way or another for exactly how that came together. It gets complicated to try to explain all of that. As I say, Jesus might have easily repeated instructions from various times. And if this is indeed written by Matthew, which is also debatable by people, he might have a personal recollection, that Mark and Luke don't have. In other words, Matthew would have been there listening to this stuff, so maybe he knows. Maybe he's saying, you know, we need to pull all this stuff here because this is actually what he said. That's possible. But it is something to keep in mind. Matthew is an organizer. I think it's fairly clear that he pulls things together thematically at times. Nothing untruthful about that. He pulls things together thematically to bring out certain points. And it's quite possible that he has pulled together these statements, which are all thematically related. They're all the same sort of thing, instructions to his disciples about what they're going to encounter when they get out there, that he might have pulled them together to have a discourse that represents Jesus' comments to his disciples about being his ministers and what they're going to find. So that's what we're going to have to sort out or think about as we go through this teaching that he gave them. Okay, so this is how the discourse begins in chapter 10, verse 5. These 12 Jesus sent out after instructing them, and now we're going to have a long thing of instruction, but I'm just going to read the very first part. Do not go in the way of the Gentiles, and do not enter any city of the Samaritans, but rather go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And as you go, preach, saying, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out demons. Freely you received, freely give. Okay, so Jesus' first instruction to them is a little disconcerting for those of us who are Gentiles, which is basically skip the Gentiles. Do not go in the way of the Gentiles and do not enter any city of the Samaritans, but rather go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Now, we know that Jesus does not have anything against Gentiles. We have already seen Jesus commend the faith of the Gentile centurion. Jesus said that that centurion and many other Gentiles would eat in the kingdom of God with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, even while many Jews will be cast out. And we saw that before this passage. It's one of the things that he said, one of the miracles that he did. In this very discourse, Jesus is going to imply, as I understand it, that one day the apostles will be giving testimony before Gentile rulers. But at this moment, Jesus wants them to go exclusively to Jewish territories. The kingdom of heaven is part of the promises made to the Jews. How do we even know about such a thing? It's because God made promises, especially through the prophets, about what he is going to do in the future. It seems that Jesus wants the Jews to be the focus of this ministry outreach. Matthew knows very well that this is only a phase. The book ends with Jesus sending the apostles out to make disciples of all the nations. But now the Jews are going to be confronted with the fulfillment of the promises God made them. And that's the focus. I really do think that we are meant to compare and contrast the instructions Jesus gives his disciples now versus the instructions he gives after the resurrection. After the resurrection, the ministry has clearly expanded to the world. What exactly are the apostles going to do when they go out there to the Jews? What sort of a ministry is this going to be? Well, this is what Jesus says. He says, "And as you go, preach, saying, 'The kingdom of heaven is at hand.' Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out demons." So, in other words, they are going to do exactly what Jesus has been doing. The first thing we are told about Jesus and his message in Matthew was that he went around saying, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." And so now he is sending the disciples out to proclaim the kingdom of heaven is at hand. The very thing that he has been proclaiming, now they are going to go around and proclaim that same thing. And likewise, in the past couple of chapters in Matthew, we have seen examples of each of these things: healing the sick, raising the dead, cleansing lepers, and casting out demons. Each of those things has happened in the stories that we have just read about. Jesus did them, and now they are to go out and to do the same thing that he has been doing. Okay, so to my mind, there's an interesting question that this raises. They are supposed to preach that the kingdom of heaven is at hand. But at this point, what is it that these guys know about the kingdom of heaven? What is it that they're going to go out and say when they talk about this? Well, presumably they know the basic message from the Old Testament. God is going to establish his righteous rule over the earth. This rule, this kingdom, will be brought about by the Messiah who will rule for God. The Messiah, the King of Israel, descended from David. They know that when that kingdom comes, the righteous dead like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob will rise and live forever. And through the Messiah, all the promises made to Israel and to the world will be fulfilled. I think they would have had that understanding, unless I'm being too optimistic, but I think they would have had that understanding. And they know the kingdom is at hand because that's what Jesus has been saying. They've heard Jesus say this over and over again. The kingdom is at hand. And now they're supposed to go out and say, the kingdom is at hand. Now, this is a big deal. This is exciting news that they're going out to proclaim. To their Jewish audience, to say the kingdom is at hand, they know a lot already. They understand that this is a big deal. David was promised that his throne would be eternal, but that was 1,000 years past, and his throne was destroyed by the Babylonians and has never been occupied since. After the Babylonians, they were ruled by the Persians and the Greeks, and now they're under the control of the Romans. One of the repeated refrains that you find in the Old Testament is, "How long, O Lord? When is this stuff going to end? When are you going to do this stuff that you talked about?" There's a psalm, Psalm 89, that's quite touching. I mean, the first part of the psalm recounts all of the, David is your guy, and you're going to do these great things, and you're going to establish his throne. And basically, the psalm is sort of poetically recounting what the Davidic covenant had said, that God was going to establish David's throne forever and all of this stuff. And then there's the turning point in the psalm, and it says, "But, God, you have cast down and destroyed, and there's no more throne, and everything's terrible." And it says, "How long, O Lord? When are you going to do what you said you were going to do?" So the disciples saying the kingdom of heaven is at hand are saying something truly momentous. For anyone who is paying attention, for anyone who had taken at all seriously what the Jews had been taught in the scriptures, The promised kingdom, the kingdom that they have desired for centuries, is at hand. So that's a very provocative and hope-inducing sort of message that they have. But did the disciples understand any more of that? If somebody had asked questions, oh, great, tell me more, what would they say? The Gospel of John shows that some of Jesus' disciples understood from the beginning at least the possibility that Jesus was the Messiah. They were talking about the question, is this the Messiah, quite early on, as far as John recounts in his Gospel. But they don't really know, and Jesus doesn't say much about it to them. In Matthew, there's a key event that has not yet happened where we are. Jesus asks his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter answers, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." At which point Jesus essentially says, "That's right. You've got it right." But that's a big deal in Matthew. So it really seems that up to that point, Jesus has not been real clear about exactly who he's claiming to be, although there are various places where he certainly hints at things. But even to the disciples, he hasn't been going around saying, "Now, you guys got this right. I'm the Messiah. Say it again. Who am I? You're the Messiah." That's not the way it's been working. So it's presented as a big deal that Peter confidently proclaims that he believes Jesus to be the Christ, the Messiah. So, as I understand it, as these disciples go out, that hasn't happened yet. And so, in their proclamation of the kingdom coming, they could tell people, "You know, I've been thinking about it. It might be that this guy Jesus is, in fact, the Messiah." But they don't really know. They can testify to what they have heard from Jesus about the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And they can testify to the miracles they saw, and they can perform miracles themselves to show that God is with Jesus and with them, his messengers. They can say that in some way, God is about to bring about the kingdom that they are waiting for. But that seems to me to be about it. That seems to be as much as they know and can say. We know that part of Matthew's purpose is to show the ways that Jesus is changing the expectations about the nature of the kingdom. There's a lot about that in Matthew. The Sermon on the Mount says a lot about who enters into that kingdom, and some of what it says is surprising. Jesus has said that many Gentiles will enter into that kingdom and many Jews will not. Later, we will see Jesus teaching in parables about the surprising ways the kingdom will come about. And in general, these parables are clarifying what is this kingdom and how does it work. And the biggest surprise of all is the fact that Jesus is going to go away. The king has come, and yet he is going to leave, and the kingdom will come in its fullness only when he returns. The disciples don't know about any of that, I don't think. That is not on their radar. In a way, I think the miracles that they do will speak more loudly. They can't explain much as teachers, but they can extend Jesus' ministry by demonstrating that God is with him through the miracles and repeat his message, the kingdom of God is at hand. Why should you believe that the kingdom of God is at hand? Because these miracles are from God. Now, what do I mean that the kingdom of God is at hand? You're going to have to talk to Jesus about that. I'm not quite sure. I think this is what seems makes sense to me from what we've seen in the text. So in a lot of ways, the disciples have as much to learn as the people that they are ministering to. Jesus also says, "Freely you received, freely give." Basically, he's saying they're not to charge people for what they're doing. But we'll talk about that more next week. That really goes together with what happens in the next verses, and I want to wait to get into the bulk of the discourse starting next week. So that's what I wanted to talk about. I have a couple of comments I want to make about what we have seen here. First, this event, the sending of the 12, it strikes me that it's very significant for you and me today. And part of the reason I'm saying that is because as a teacher of the Bible, I often say this, that in my journey toward trying to understand what's going on in the Bible, I am often having to overcome my own sort of confusion about what it is that I'm looking at. And I know that when I have read these sections about sending out the 12, I have never been all that interested. But when I started reading the Bible, I would read that and go, you know, this is like you go to the Broadway play and they put on the understudies. You know, what do I care about sending out the 12? I've already got the big message from the big guy himself, and I know about the resurrection and all that stuff. Those guys knew nothing, so why do I even care? I mean, I know this is an embarrassing admission, but this is kind of how I felt about it. It's like, who cares? But I think it is significant. In thinking more about it over the years, it seems to me to be more significant than I had been willing to give it credit for being. It might not seem so at first that it would be relevant to you and me, because you and me are mostly Gentiles, and after all, this was a mission aimed specifically at the lost sheep of the house of Israel, in exclusion to the Gentiles. I mean, he's deliberately saying, no, we're not. I'm not sending you to them. If I had been living in a Gentile territory back then, I would have been skipped entirely. I wouldn't have even known probably that this was going on, because they didn't come to me. The promises of the kingdom were made to the Jews, and that message was proclaimed first to the Jews. And the reaction of the Jewish people to this ministry is a very important part of the story Matthew is telling. So there's a strong Jewish element to what's happening here that is not immediately relevant to me. But in another sense, you and I are very much hovering in the background in this story. We are, because Jesus is taking a very important first step toward passing his ministry over to his disciples. I mean, they don't really understand it at this point, but ultimately he's going to leave and say, you guys are doing it. So right now, on this occasion, they are being sent out to speak for him and to act for him. They are being sent out as apostles, as messengers. And of course, ultimately what's going to happen is that Jesus is going to leave, and he is really going to pass the ball to them. He's going to say, now you are going to go out, you are going to speak for me, and you're going to act for me. You and I know about Jesus because of the work of the apostles. Jesus never wrote anything down. We know about him through his representatives and the people that they taught. And this story in chapter 10 is about the first time the 12 disciples take on that task. We can see the broader implications of this story in the way Matthew tells it, at least as I see it right now. We'll see this more clearly as we move on in the text. But as I mentioned before, as at the beginning of this discourse, Jesus starts out by focusing on this immediate mission to the Jews right now. This is what you're going to do. But as he goes along, his comments start to look ahead to times when the disciples will be speaking before Gentile rulers. It's an expansive, ultimately, picture of what they're going to be doing. So Matthew seems to understand this initial mission of the 12 as a first step toward their ultimate global mission, even though, in fact, it is very much aimed at the Jews. And that ultimate global mission is where you and I come in. So in a sense, we can kind of perk up and go, when he sends them out like that, that's relevant, because that's where we are. We are disciples of Jesus through the apostles. That's who we are. I have one last comment to make. I want to read again from 9:36. It says, seeing the people, he felt compassion for them, because they were distressed and dispirited like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Therefore, beseech the Lord of the harvest to send out workers into his harvest. So Jesus is kind of painting a picture, as I would understand it here. Once again, agricultural ignorance, you have to remember. But Jesus is kind of like a farmer looking out over a field, and he's recognizing there are plants here that are producing. They are ready to be harvested. We need to go out and bring in the harvest. I think he means that God, the Lord of the harvest, has prepared the hearts of many people to respond to the message and enter into the kingdom of God. But workers are needed to bring in this harvest. What exactly is it, though, that these workers can do? What are those workers going to go out there and accomplish? Jesus is sending out the disciples because he has compassion for the lost sheep. But what exactly is the compassionate thing that the disciples are going to do? Well, we might say that miracles of healing are compassionate acts, and they are. That's true. Absolutely, they are. It is a truly compassionate act to free individual persons from sickness, demonic possession, or death. So those are acts of compassion. But as we have seen earlier or in previous weeks, the miracles are even more important as signs, as pointers to something greater. I think the most compassionate thing that the disciples are going to do is to proclaim the coming of the kingdom. People need to hear this message. It is the door to true restoration. It is their teaching. It is their proclamation that is going to be the act of compassion. In the Gospel of Mark, we see another occasion where Jesus feels compassion, very, very similar expression to what we find in Matthew, in Mark 6:34. When Jesus went ashore, he saw a large crowd, and he felt compassion for them because they were like sheep without a shepherd, and he began to teach them many things. He felt compassion for them. They were like sheep without a shepherd. So what did he do? He began to teach them. He talked to them. He explained things to them. What did these sheep without a shepherd need? They needed to be led to understanding. They needed to know what was important. They needed to know about repentance and hope and the promises of God and the central issues of their existence. They needed someone to help them see what was really going on. And this is the thing that I wanted to highlight here. It seems to me that this is our great motivation to minister, to evangelize, to just encourage each other as individual Christians. We cannot reach into hearts of others to move them to believe. I can't go out there and make people believe or turn them into believers. That is a job for the Spirit of God. But we can do them the great kindness of helping them to understand the great issues of life better. I have often used the analogy, as the Bible does, of a journey through the wilderness. It makes all the difference in the world whether we are lost in the wilderness or whether we are journeying through the wilderness to some desirable goal. Think of what a gift it would be to learn that you were not lost as you wandered in the wilderness. You were traveling someplace greatly desirable. Think of how you would bless and praise the person who helped you to understand that. Think about how important it would be to you that you had gotten some clarity, some understanding of what your situation is, because somebody has helped you to see that. Well, that is what we have the opportunity to do for each other. We can encourage each other by reminding each other of the truth. You know, I'm not exactly a Reformed theologian, but I do have that same perspective on, that perspective on the sovereignty of God in working in the hearts of people to open their eyes and bring them into the kingdom and so on. That sort of a theology has often been charged with being uninterested in evangelism. Because, hey, God is just going to do it. God's going to open hearts. So what's the point in talking to people about it? Those who get in are going to get in, and I can't change anything about that. But this is where that sense of compassion enters into things. We understand that it is a great gift to understand better where I am in life. What's going on? If I am on a journey, a meaningful journey, then it changes things. It makes life look different. It makes the choices that I'm going to make different. You can't make those choices for me, but you can help me to understand what my choices are built on. Why am I going to submit to this truth? Why am I going to treat people a certain way? Why am I not going to give up and blow my brains out? I mean, all of those things. Because I have come to understand that life is one way and not another. I think that's what we see in this passage. What the disciples have the opportunity to do is to extend the compassion of Jesus to others by bringing them what they have come to understand from him. You and I are not Jesus. We are students of Jesus, inferior students of Jesus. He knows a lot more about this than we do. We cannot claim to have all the answers. But we can explain to people what we think the Bible is saying. We can encourage each other with its truths as we understand them. We can remind each other of the great and central truths of the Bible as best we understand them. We can extend the compassion of Jesus to other people in ways similar to what the apostles did. That is, we pass on to them as best we can what we understand about where hope is to be found and the choices that we have in front of us. We can tell them the crucial things that they need to know. We don't have to be official teachers to do that. I mean, we can just do that in conversation. I can be talking to my wife, and she can encourage me to remember what's going on, what's the important stuff, which she has often done. That's a great gift that we can give to each other. Finding some clarity and understanding in the midst of the turmoil of life is a great gift from God, and it is one of the gifts that God allows us to participate in giving. Okay, fini. So we have a few minutes for any questions or comments you may have. Pregnant silence is appropriate as well, if you want. Hello.
Hello. Why was Peter always listed first, especially since, like, Andrew came to Jesus before he did? I mean.
Well, I assume that it's because of what we're going to find. I talked about that time when Peter is the one who speaks up and says, "You're the Christ," and Jesus says, "On this rock I'm going to build my church," which is, you know, we'll have to talk about what's happening with that exactly, but Peter is clearly seen to be of kind of central importance in among the disciples, I think, in the way that he is treated by Jesus. In the end of John, when Jesus takes Peter aside and says, "Feed my lambs," and all that sort of thing. So I think the church came to believe that Peter was kind of first among equals, if you understand that kind of thing. So, yeah, I don't think it's chronological. Peter was not the first one to come to know who Jesus was, but he came to have this position of importance. That's what I would think.
And it's always also interesting, given that he was also, the story is told about his betraying Jesus, too.
Right. Well, that's part of, I mean, sometimes God gives people an important role to play by taking them through all kinds of stuff. And Peter was taken through all kinds of stuff in his journey toward being a faithful apostle and leader in the church. I have always believed that his act of betrayal was a terrible thing, but it was also a hugely important thing in his life, a hugely important thing for him to have to confront and think about, what does all this mean to me? What am I really about here? So yeah, I think that's why he's first. Remember, Paul talks about Peter and James and John, is that the three, who are reputed to be pillars when he's writing in Galatians.
Yeah. How big of a deal is this event in the here and in Luke and Mark? They seem, it's sort of like, and then they went off, And it could be a long time that mm-hmm. this is going on. It
right.
could be, in terms of the actual event, it could have been a bigger deal than Jesus' whole ministry.
Yes.
Do you have any sense of that? Or do you have any sense of what it must have been like? Or
well, we don't know a lot. The most that we would know are those times when they come back. There's this, I don't remember what Matthew has here, but in somewhere in the Synoptic Gospels, there is the account of how they come back and they're all jazzed. You know, it's like you come back from camp or something. I said, man, we did this and we did this. And Jesus says, I was seeing Satan falling like lightning. So they seem to have been at it long enough that they were out there and they were having a variety of experiences that they could come back and say, wow, this was cool. We also know that they were out there and they were screwing up sometimes, because there's that one event when somebody comes to Jesus and says, your disciples are worthless. I have a problem here, and they don't seem to be able to do anything about it. So yeah, I think it is interesting that it is an important event, and it is also true that we don't know much about what happened. None of the disciples that I can think of, I mean, in Peter's letters and in John's letters, they don't look back and tell the story of what it is that they did during that time. So I think it's a big deal that it went on for a while, and for whatever reason, we're not told much about the details of what happened. It's kind of what it seems like.
So he sends them out, and he gives them this glowing prediction of how they're going to be treated,
mm-hmm.
Hated, persecuted, pursued. And Jesus spoke to them in parables so that seeing they would not see and hearing they would not hear. Is this another example, the example of his obvious presence and power and authority that the people just reject? They don't care.
The people, meaning the people who are listening to the apostles when they go out to do this?
The people that reject them and pursue them and persecute them. And it's almost like, because I can't see Jesus saying, go out there, you're going to knock them dead. You're going to have like 70% confessions here.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you're going to be harassed and harried and rejected. And it made me think of, you know, why do you teach in parables? Because it says that when I come, they will not see me or hear me. And so here he's sending them out almost like saying, go out there and they'll reject you.
Okay, yeah, but let me come down on the other side of this. Remember, he starts out by saying, the harvest is plentiful. And I think he doesn't just mean there are a lot of people out there to talk up to. I think he's talking from the perspective of there's a harvest ready to come in here for those who will go out and proclaim this message. Now, the interesting thing about the story of that time is that when Jesus himself was doing this and he sends the disciples out, there was a lot of initial interest, but actually by the end of his ministry, there it's not like he has this huge number of believers. I mean, they're out there, but they're kind of scattered. And it was in Acts when his disciples are now fully prepared, I'll use that language, to carry on, to speak and act for Jesus, that they proclaim this message, and now you have all of these people who are believing. So I kind of always associate in my mind that the harvest is plentiful, that Jesus is seeing past just the initial thing that they're going to do here, but there are actually many Jews out there. I mean, ultimately, the Jewish people are going to kind of walk away from this, but there are many Jews out there who are ready to believe, who are prepared, whose hearts are prepared to believe this stuff, just as there will be these Gentiles when it expands out to the Gentile churches. So it's not all doom and gloom. And the stuff that we're going to look at immediately next time, he is actually presenting a picture where he thinks that you will be able to find, probably, in a village that you go into, somebody who actually is interested enough in what you're doing that they will take you in and, you know, feed you and make sure that your needs are taken care of because they're a worthy person. So it's not what he presents as a scenario, though, is that some will do that, but some will not do that, and you're going to shake the dust off your sandals and all of that, and we'll talk about that stuff next time. But I think it's kind of a mixed picture there. So partly what the disciples are going to be experiencing, I think, as much as the compassion of Jesus being extended to the people, they are getting this initial sort of experience now with the kinds of responses that people give to this. I mean, they're starting to see, oh, this is complicated. You can't just say the kingdom is at hand and everybody goes, yay. It's more complicated than that. And that's what they're going to see when they enter into the fullness of their ministry. They are going to find a great deal of interest and a great deal of opposition both. And so it kind of seems like it's the beginning of that in that sense, if that answers your question. Okay, well, go home and be cool.